It's the Supreme Court edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Secularism 101, Supreme Court, and more. Imagine no religion interviews. Now let's begin the numerically correct episode 115.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. So Ethan, has it been an interesting week? Did you do anything, I don't know, inappropriate on the weekend? Perhaps something that your mother wouldn't approve of?
My mother approves of everything I do.
Oh.
But I did have a great weekend. I attended the Vancouver Slut Walk. And no, that's not a dirty word. That's what it's called. It was organized in response to comments by a Toronto police officer who suggested that women should avoid dressing like sluts in order not to be victimized.
That seems kind of counterintuitive. I mean, first of all, what qualifies as quote-unquote dressing slutty?
Well, that's one point.
And two, I mean, that means that shops shouldn't have money in them because that's just asking to be robbed.
Exactly. It's what we like to call victim blaming, where we put the blame on the woman who was assaulted and not the assaulter who, well, assaulted them. And anyway, the event, though, in Vancouver was very successful. I was really surprised. There was a great crowd of people, I'd say around 1,000 people, perhaps a bit more, represented by both women and men. And, you know, it didn't turn creepy the way Boobquake did, where you had a bunch of, well, CD people with cameras. This was actually a lot of people who showed up. You know, some people were dressed up, some people were just there carrying signs, and some people were there just to show their support. And it was, you know, went across very well.
You know, probably one of the reasons why it wasn't quite as seedy as you thought is, I don't know if you've ever been out at Halloween, but the quality of costume and the level of celebrity has led to Halloween being somewhat slutty itself as far as the dress of people. So I suspect as far as creepy people wanting to get a quick peek like they would have at Boobquake, that maybe that helped make this more of a serious event.
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, it was raining, and it was on the chilly side, so it wasn't like anyone was going to be walking around.
No, yeah, that would be perfect, because, I mean, we know those kind of people like to have the long raincoats on so they can...
Well, there were a few people there who were wearing, I think, less than legally is normally required for walking around Vancouver. But, like I said, I thought it was a great message. It was really successful. There were a lot of great talks. The one thing that I thought was a little irksome was I was reading an article in the newspaper, and it suggested that... you know, like 1,000 angry feminists marched around Vancouver. And I think that's kind of a misnomer. One, it's a very serious message, but they weren't angry. It wasn't like screaming obscenities type protest. It was in its own way kind of a fun event, but it was optimistic. And I think people left feeling empowered and hopeful. And that was the message I got from it. It wasn't this, you know, angry, obscene protest that I thought perhaps was being painted in the newspaper.
Well, what about the claims? I mean, some people think, you know, using the S word, slut, is in itself sort of a derogatory term. And although I understand some people have justified it in sort of taking this negative term and taking it away from them, like black people use the N word and queer community uses queer, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, doesn't that sort of lead to a certain militancy that, you know, you might use the slut word, but we're going to take it back, and that just by choosing that word was in itself kind of an aggressive tone to take.
Sure. I mean, that's a tricky issue, and I have no answer for that issue. I think that part of why the organizers used that was because that was the word that the Toronto police officer used. And that sort of became the rallying cry. And that it is attention-grabbing. You know, if you say you're going to the anti-victimization protest walk versus I went to the slut walk, one of them gets your attention a lot more than the other.
Well, don't they have Take Back the Nights? Isn't that also, I mean, not the same, but in a similar sort of vein?
Yeah. And like, there was lost representation. There were people there talking about, you know, like from like women's shelters and battered women's shelters. People who were representative of the downtown east side, where obviously it's a very poor community. There's not a lot of legal protection for people there. And I think it was a nice mix of people basically saying, you know, we're tired of victim blaming, of saying, oh, you were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Sorry. You know, there is blame when someone, you know, rapes somebody and it's not with the victim.
You know, and this is funny too for people who keep an ear on what happens down south. There was a case recently where a 12-year-old, I think it was 12-year-old, has been sort of accused of being the perpetrator in a bizarre way of gang rape. That there was like 12 guys ranging in ages from something like 15 to 22 or something like that, raped this girl over a period of time. And they were blaming her because she was dressing sluttily. She was asking for it. And like this was almost prepubescent type, mm-hmm. You know, and I'm going, What the hell is going on?
Yeah, it's absolutely insane. I think if the response was anything, it's a good start and you know, long way to go, but it's a good place to start.
You know, and you said something that I thought was interesting. You said, you know, some of the people were wearing things that were, you know, perhaps not quite legal. And that leads me to wonder, well, who exactly defines the laws of the land?
That is a good question. I would like to know the answer to that question.
Well, the ultimate law in the land is the Supreme Court. And one of the things we've had scheduled to get on the show for about 4 episodes now was what I'd called a hidden election issue. Of course, it's too late to be an election issue, but it's still something I think people should be aware of and should be interested in. It's the Supreme Court of Canada. First of all, where does the Supreme Court of Canada fit into our system? Originally, the Supreme Court of Canada was not actually supreme. In fact, it wasn't until the British Privy Council was abolished in 1949 that it became sort of the last court of appeal. And it was in sort of a legal limbo until the repatriation of our Constitution in 1982, at which point it truly did become the Supreme Court. In 1982, it not only became the Supreme Court in ruling on the letter of the law, but it also became the interpreter and the meaning of and the implementation of the Constitution, our Charter of Rights, as well as a unique role as far as answering reference questions. Reference questions occur when the Governor General, on behalf of the Prime Minister, asks the court if a proposed law would be constitutional or not, a sort of prejudgment of law. And this was quite important because one of the things was if Quebec had passed a law of separation, would it have been legal and what criteria would have been legal? And even before such a law existed, the Supreme Court made a ruling on that. So that's sort of the idea. Why are they important? Well, as I sort of said, you know, Parliament may make the law, but how that law is actually enforced in our country, or even if it remains a law, lies at the hands of the Supreme Court. One great example of this is the whole idea of abortion. For a number of years, the Supreme Court of Canada held that there should be limitations on abortions. However, in 1988, the court struck down our laws, and to this date, we have no law on abortion. We're one of the few countries in the world that treat abortion as a purely medical matter between doctor and patient. Similar other landmarks type decisions came about, like the recognition of Aboriginal rights, the definition of hate speech, the limitations of free speech, and things like language laws, etc.
You know, what I find interesting about the Supreme Court is that it can overrule the provincial Supreme Courts, but the provinces don't have any kind of say in the vetting process of who gets on the Supreme Court.
Well, actually, it's quite interesting on how who's on the Supreme Court itself.
Right.
The court itself is currently comprised of 9 members. By law, 3 of them must be from Quebec. By tradition, and in Canada, there's a big thing mixing tradition and legislation together. By tradition, 3 are from Ontario, 2 are from, quote-unquote, the West, and 1 from the Maritimes. Ironic, one of the things I thought was interesting, that before a court actually hears a case, it must be approved by a committee, which is made up of at least three justices, and they may say, no, we're just not going to take it. So in a way, you've got two court challenges. The first one is just to get approved to be seen, and then they actually rule on it. Of course, once it's been approved, it must be heard by anywhere from 5 to 9 judges, unlike the American Supreme Court, where all 9 justices must be present, if they can be. There's been a few cases where there's been few, but that's the sort of thing where a justice retired and they replaced sort of in mid-session, but normally they all sort of listen in. At the moment, there are 9 judges, 6 of which have been appointed by the Liberals, 3 by the Conservatives. However, the next 4 years, 5 more members are going to be replaced by Harper, giving him 7 out of the 9 justices will be sort of Harper appointees. And that's not taking into consideration any of them that might get sick. Out of the 5, 4 of them are retirees. 1 has announced an early retirement in themselves. Now, how are they appointed? Well, that's actually a very interesting question in itself. First, I should just lay out, as I've kind of mentioned before, there are 2 parts to the Canadian Constitution. There's sort of the legislative aspect of it, and there's the convention aspect of it. The legislative aspect are those parts of the Constitution that are sort of written down, such as the Constitution Act of 1982 or Charter of Rights and Freedoms. These are actually laws passed in the land. Another part of it is convention. Those parts that are followed not because they're prescribed by law, but by tradition. You know, it's always been done that way, so we keep doing it that way. A great example of this is the Governor General does not have to sign a bill into law. There is no legal requirement or even a legal means for Parliament to sidestep the necessity of royal assent. So for all those people who want to get rid of the monarchy, the anti-monarchist, one of the big fundamental hurdles is, in an odd way, you have to get the Queen to agree to get rid of herself, because even if Parliament did pass a law to abrogate the Queen, she still has to sign it into law. And that's funny, I think.
That is funny.
But of course, you know, by convention, the Governor General has never refused to give consent to a bill passed by Parliament. Although in doing my research, I did find out, I think in the 30s, a Lieutenant Governor, who was a provincial version of our Governor General, refused to pass 3 bills passed by the Social Credit Government for reasons that he deemed they were unconstitutional by that time. And as it turned out, the Governor General was proven right. Because eventually these laws did make it to the Supreme Court of Canada and they were struck down, but he never did actually sign them into law, which makes me wonder how they got to the Supreme Court, but I'm not a legal expert. Moving on.
Right.
So, the appointment of the justice to the Supreme Court, again, falls largely into the convention part of our Constitution. So technically, they have to be members of the bar, so by law they have to be lawyers or judges, and they're appointed by the Governor General on advice from the Privy Council. But of course, in fact, they're selected really at the whim of the Prime Minister. Of course, when I say the whim of the Prime Minister, he's also bound by certain conventions. And as it sort of works out is that he's presented with a number of candidates by the province that is, quote-unquote, due its seat. So traditionally, like I say, Quebec, if it's a Quebec justice that steps down, Quebec will present it. The West, in quotes, tends to rotate. So you get one from BC, one from Alberta, one from Saskatchewan, one from Manitoba, and then back to BC. And each one of those provincial legal bodies, so not the Supreme Court of BC, but the BC Bar Association, will present some candidates and say, these are the ones we think you should choose from. That being said, it's been argued that, you know, there's just way too much power in the Prime Minister, because the Prime Minister can, in theory, appoint anybody who is a lawyer or a judge for whatever reason he deems, and he doesn't have to tell anyone why. So, ironically enough, Harper, when he was opposition leader, proposed that the justice should be appointed, or at least approved, reviewed, by a committee of the commons. And, to be fair, once he got into power, he created this committee for his first appointment, and quickly abandoned the whole process, saying it was too slow and too political. So now we have 1 PM who's about to appoint 7 justices, although this isn't quite a unique feature in our history. It does give him an unprecedented ability to sort of put a thumbprint on our court And considering the recent history of increased polarization and bipartisanism, even in Canada, things may change. If we take a look at what's happened south of the border, right? I mean, in the American Supreme Court, and this first part I'm going to lay out there, people know I am not exactly politically unbiased, that I do tend to say things in a slightly partisan way. So the next paragraph I'm about to sort of say, take with a grain of salt, and I understand if you sit there and say, Jesus Christ, Don, why don't you just say things normally? That being said, so after years and years of lobbying the American Supreme Court, some people have argued that the American Supreme Court has become the judicial branch of the Republican Party, promoting a right-wing neocon agenda. For example, Clarence Thomas and Anthony Scalia are quite noteworthy in their active participation in a number of right-wing gatherings. Clarence Thomas's wife is a lobbyist for a prominent Tea Party. We don't quite have these same problems here in Canada now, but what tends to happen there seems to sadly creep up to us in about a decade or two later. So things to be looking on the end. They're also, again, super important as far as how the running goes. A lot of people may remember the quote-unquote, what some people have called the Supreme Court coup d'etat of 2000, where the Supreme Court essentially decided who would be president of the United States. There's the Citizen United's case, which has its implications. Now, again, don't get me wrong. You know, I mean, they're not making the law up as they go. All of this is just how they're interpreting the law and how big of a ruling they give based on their interpretation, which again just shows that the Supreme Court itself can have huge and dramatic implications. And why am I using American examples? Well, let's give the Americans credit. When it comes to extremism and very colorful sort of examples, they do it much better than we do. There are a few interesting cases coming up in Canada, but none of them quite as, oh my God, I can't believe they did that sort of ones they do in the States.
Right.
So that being said, the Canadian Constitution is itself, well, in the United States, they kind of have two modes of interpreting the Constitution. There are those who believe in sort of the living Constitution, that the founders wrote the Constitution, but it's to evolve over time and give rise to new laws that reflect how society has changed over time. There are others who are literalists, there's another word they used, but literalist, who essentially say, well, this is the words they wrote, and we must uphold to the meaning of those words. Not in a knee-jerk sort of, if they say that transportation by buggy between two states is illegal if it contains alcohol, well, a truck and a buggy mean the same thing. So it's not an absolutely literalist point of view, but the meaning is literal. Mm-hmm. And one of the great examples is the whole idea of capital punishment. Most civilized countries in the world have abolished capital punishment because it seemed to be cruel and unusual punishment, right? And that, therefore, a violation of someone's civil rights. Anthony Scalia in the States has argued that, well, when the framers of the Constitution wrote it, they had meant that capital punishment wasn't at the time deemed cruel and unusual. Therefore, it cannot be reinterpreted now as being cruel and unusual. Therefore, capital punishment is legal. Now, Canada, being the wonderful bastion of freedom that we are, you're not laughing, Ethan. That's good.
Yeah.
Our Constitution is based on a doctrine called the Living Tree Doctrine, or the Doctrine of Progressive Interpretation. Now, this is actually something from some nice...
This is not like a maple tree or something.
Well, you know, we have to be Canadian, and so we take whatever we have and make it uniquely ours. Lord Sankey, about 60 to 80 years ago, I'm not quite sure on the date, wrote that the British North America Act planted in Canada a living tree capable of growth and expansion within its natural limits. So this means that the Canadian Constitution cannot be interpreted in a way as any other ordinary statute. That is, it must be read in the context of a society and to ensure that, you know, it adapts and reflects the changes in Canada. So for now, anyhow, the idea of a literalist interpretation of Canadian law doesn't seem, or Canadian Constitution, seems to be almost anathema to how we have our constitutional thing. Mm-hmm. That all being said, why have I brought this up at all? Well, we should remember that we have Harper now as a majority leader of our country, and he has all this power to appoint Supreme Justices. And a number of political commentators have noted that he's extremely controlling and somewhat dictatorial, that his power over his party has been quite absolute and markedly different than it has been in the past. That, with the idea that he has shown contempt for Parliament, I would like to remind people that the Conservative governments were actually convicted of contempt of Parliament, not only for lying to Parliament, but for also not providing government information to the committees of Parliament. And as such, one must wonder that if Harper is allowed to appoint people who shares his ideological bent, what this might mean in the future over such things, you know. Let me take a step back. There are a lot of things I disagree with conservatives on, right? And there are fair debates. And, you know, how much power should a corporation have versus not? Sure, we can agree to disagree, and that's fair. But there have been such things. I mean, Harper has been somewhat outed as a climate change denier, which flies in the face of most skeptics' beliefs, right? Members of his party have put out that marriage and abortion should be restricted based on religious grounds. Again, something that our community thinks shouldn't have any say in this. Mm-hmm. The G20 was a horrible denial of individual and political rights. There's a whole bunch of things that are done or coming up. Sorry, did I mention election fraud? That the Conservative Party was charged with election, and you guys voted them back in power. My God! Okay, sorry, deep breaths. So, the Supreme Court, a very important issue, something to keep your eyes on. There are a bunch of cases coming up in the Supreme Court that we should be coming up, and actually, we'll probably be making it a semi-regular segment to highlight one of these Supreme Court issues, do a little five-minute segment. If there's a Supreme Court issue you know that's coming up, a court case coming up, for example, one of the ones that affects us here in Vancouver is the legality of the safe injection site, which Harper has sworn on his grave, to shut down in spite of all the scientific evidence that shows that it is a success and actually should be expanded. The Supreme Court is going to be asked to rule on this, that any law that abrogates a person's civil rights has to be both proportional to the damage done and as minimalist as possible. And the safe injection site people are arguing that it doesn't meet these criteria because the harm inflicted by denying these people a safe injection site is grossly disproportionate to whatever harm that might be done if you just let them do it. Mm-hmm. So, again, you know, and there's a number of other issues I have here, which I'll save for future episodes. And Ethan, are you going to be on the Supreme Court someday?
Well, it's unlikely that I will be on the Supreme Court since I'm not a lawyer or a judge. But who knows? Maybe we'll get a prime minister who's a little wacky and will put me on the Supreme Court. But until then, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
You're listening to
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Ice cream man, can I have this? I want this over here, and a toast on by my father, and give me this ice over here, and vanilla cone. Thank you, ice cream man. Thank you, ice cream man.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and The Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. So the next big bit of skeptical news to discuss is A Course in Secularism.
Huh?
See, I'm sure people have heard of courses in theology and courses in religious studies. What you may never have heard of is a course in secularism. Well, now, a small liberal arts college in Southern California will offer a course this fall in secularism. And that college is Pfister College, which is in Southern California. And professors from other departments, including history, philosophy, religion, science, and sociology, will create a new department on secularism. And they're going to teach courses like God, Darwin, and Design in America, Anxiety in the Age of Reason, and The Bible as Literature. Sounds pretty interesting. And I think about time. We've all, you know, had to see the theology department teaching about religion in contemporary life and religious studies, doing sort of comparative analysis of religion. But we haven't really examined the growing trend of secularism in our society.
But Ethan, theological people, they actually believe in something. Don't atheists or secularists innately not believe? So aren't you kind of studying people who believe in nothing?
Well, if you're studying nihilism, but no. See, this course, as I understand it, is designed to explore the changes in society that are secularizing across the world. So Canada, America, Europe, why this is happening, where it's happening, what forces are motivating it. I would imagine it's kind of like combining sociology and sort of contemporary political science, maybe. But that's perhaps getting ahead of things. The new department at Pfister College will be organized by Professor Phil Zuckerman, who is a sociologist of religion, and he's also written a couple books that listeners might be familiar with, including Society Without God, Atheism and Secularity, and the soon-to-be-published Faith No More, Why People Reject Religion.
Sorry, not related to the Facebook Zuckerman, is it?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, maybe, but probably not. The purpose of the course is not to debate the existence of God. Rather, it is to study the path of secularization. So this isn't a course where you're going to get people together and say, okay, here's why God doesn't exist. I think that's just a tangential conversation that doesn't happen here. I think the focus is going to be on why does society secularize? What benefits, what pros and cons do we notice in a society that is more secular versus a society that is more theological? The focus will be on both the individual, so why people are leaving religion, but also on the state level, why countries like Canada are secularizing as fast as they are. Now, of course, I think this is great news. I think it's going to be a very fascinating course, but this doesn't sit well with some conservative Christians. Ken Ham, a young earth creationist and writer, has decried the course as teaching atheism, and believes that since colleges are already teaching secularization, why they need a department on secular studies in the first place.
How are they teaching secularization? Or does he mean this as a knee-jerk?
He means it as sort of like, you know, colleges and universities are already making students into little atheists, so why do we need a course designed for it? He believes that since Zuckerman is an agnostic atheist, the course will not be taught neutrally. I have a quote from Ken Ham. People have this idea that, a professor's personal beliefs don't affect the way that they teach, he said. Well, the Bible says, as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. So clearly that makes a lot of sense. I think Ken Ham is being ridiculous here, but that's just my opinion.
I wonder if you made this comment on a Sunday, because wouldn't you get stoned? Isn't there something about working on a Sunday?
Well, I'm sure
if he wants to be a Bible literalist, I'd be interested.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he would have taken that into account.
Oh. But yeah, no, I mean, in the odd sort of way, you know, the counter argument goes that the only people who can teach a theological class is someone who is either Catholic or, you know, depending on the course of that. But I mean, there's a great number of examples where you have people who are of mixed faiths teaching theological classes that don't actually agree with the course that they're teaching, and that doesn't seem to be a huge issue. And I don't think, I mean, I'd feel a little uncomfortable, but I don't think I'd have a real problem that if someone was even a theologian going being part of this department, you know, but I don't think it would necessarily rule him out.
I don't think there's any rule that to be a theologian you have to be religious. I think as long as you know the material, you would be qualified to teach it.
In an odd sort of way, a theologian would have a very distinctive perspective on the changes in society caused by secularism.
Yeah, exactly. I think that a theologian would be able to understand, first how the religion originated, as well as how its doctrines have changed and the interpretation of the doctrine has changed over the years. Now, Ham, on the other hand, seems to be missing that point. He seems to think that this course is teaching students to be atheists. But that's sort of like Ham thinking that if you take a course on German history, you'll turn into a German. So I think he's got the completely wrong idea, which doesn't surprise me. He's a creationist after
exactly.
all.
Exactly. So what would you think if one of these people were... What if Ham got somehow on this in this faculty and was teaching a course? Because if you remember, we did an episode a while ago about a young Earth creationist who was also a astronomer. And we did come kind of harshly down saying that guy should be... it was important not to let him teach. Would that play into this particular field or not?
I think that if you're a creationist and you're teaching in this department, that does sort of lend to some cognitive dissonance. I mean, on the one hand, I don't see a problem with a religious person being in this department because, again, we're talking about religion. And as long as this person isn't using that opportunity to proselytize, it should be okay. I mean, in the case of other creationist teaching, you know, if they're teaching about biology, that's a conflict of interest. If they're teaching about astronomy or economics or something that's sort of mundanely not related to biology, well, reasonably that's okay. I mean, I'm sure people have a lot of crazy beliefs every now and then, and you can still get by as long as you compartmentalize them sufficiently.
And in the sense that someone who is a devout religious person may actually be able to teach the Bible as literature quite well because their understanding
sure.
of it would be...
Yeah, absolutely. And, I'm going to be interested to see how this works out. It's too bad that this isn't being offered at UBC. Then I could take the course, but...
Isn't that correspondence?
Yeah, maybe, actually. We'll have to see about that. Well, let's go to another commercial break here on Radio Freethinker. After the commercial break, we'll have a series of interviews from our time in Kamloops, including an interview with Stuart Beckman, who is the past president of Atheist Alliance International, and Jem McCrite, who is the author of the popular blog Blaghag. So stay tuned for that here on Radio Freethinker.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
State of hip hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
Okay, joining us now is Stuart Beckman, who is the president of Atheists United of Los Angeles and the past president of Atheist Alliance International. Stuart, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So what do you think of the Imagine No Religion conference? Are you having a good time?
Oh, it's a great conference. I'm very excited about the energy I'm seeing here.
The big news at the moment is the missing, perhaps theft, of the atheist bus that's in Kelowna. Well, what's your take on this bizarre series of events?
Oh, I don't know if it's bizarre, is it? I think it should have been actually fairly expected. Secularism is a very threatening concept to many religious people, and they're told it's a threatening thing. So when we are daring to be visible enough to be seen by the religious community, they lash out and take action to try to deal with their fear. And it is just strictly a fear. It's strictly a fear of really not knowing what the secular community is about, what atheists are about. They only know what the religious leaders told them. And so, you know, if you're told that atheists are the incarnation of evil walking the earth and they're going to destroy your faith and mine, you know, tearing down a few billboards is the least you could do.
Right. And obviously, you're an American. Can you give us a bit of perspective of what atheism is like in America versus what atheism is like in Canada?
Well, I'm not sure I can speak much on how it is in Canada, but I've been involved with the free thought community for the past 15 years, and despite the Enlightenment values I talked about in my talk that the United States was created out of, atheists are very marginalized. They're very invisible, and whenever they speak out, you know, they're slapped down. There's a negative response. We've had the same kind of campaigns that we have in British Columbia and Kelowna here. We've been having in New York City and places around the United States, and very much the same reactions. We have bus drivers who refuse to drive buses. We have advertising companies who receive thousands of angry calls to take down the ads, and city councils passing motions to ban any sort of advertising that would allow atheists to be visible. So I don't know how that compares to Canada. From what I heard today, it sounds like it's fairly similar, but it's certainly not as tolerant and diverse a society as we certainly would hope it would be.
Speaking about atheists standing up and being heard, do you have a preference on the type of method? Do you favor being more confrontational, or do you favor being more accommodating?
It depends. It depends on the situation. You know, if you can use humor and sarcasm to make your point, then you should use it, depending on the situation. There are certain places where it's much better to be calm and reasoned and not snarky and to be heard. Otherwise, people just shut you down. Oh, you're the, you know, the problem when you get mocking or sarcastic is that feeds into the stereotype of the militant and the antisocial atheist. So that's not always a good place to be.
I wanted to ask you about a controversy that happened in 2009 when Atheist Alliance International gave its Richard Dawkins Award to Bill Maher. I imagine you anticipate the question. Bill Maher is known to be an anti-vaxxer, denier of germ theory. There was a fair bit of criticism that he received this award. What's your response to that criticism?
Well, I think it was unwarranted. Now, certainly he does not... he certainly does have unconventional views, especially on vaccines and medicine, and we knew that going into it, but that wasn't why he received the award. He received the award for his efforts to, you know, bring the struggle of tolerance or intolerance towards atheists to the forefront. He's a major media figure. He talks about religion and the consequences and harms that are out there, and the injustices that go on for the free thought community. That's big. I mean, the award isn't to award somebody for being a secular saint. The award is for making a difference out in the society and the community for our community, and he did that. Mm-hmm. He does that every day.
Do you consider that atheism and skepticism are two different tracks, or do you think they're a continuum?
I like continuum. That's a good way to put it. I like to think of myself as both an atheist and a skeptic, but I know that there are some skeptics who don't want to take a position or just haven't taken a position, if it's conceivable to do that, on religion, that they just want to look at, you know, charlatanism and questionable medical practices, but they stay away from the religion thing. And I don't fault them for it. I don't demand that skeptics adopt the label of atheist or humanist or even agnostic. That kind of labeling is very personal, and people adopt those labels for very individual reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, I think it's on a continuum, or maybe a scattershot of the labels that fit you best. In fact, I use different labels depending on the environment I'm in. I like the term atheist because if I want to make a very quick, sharp explanation of who I am and where my values are, I don't have to explain very much when I say atheist. But if I say I'm bright, you know, maybe I'm in a situation where I don't want to, you know, I want to, you use another word like agnostic or bright or even skeptic or humanist. If you are not in a confrontational environment, that might be a better way for the other person to hear where you're at or start a conversation. So I don't fault anyone for picking whatever label or not. There's lots of label wars in the free thought community, and I just stay out of them.
Right. You were talking about the Enlightenment today. Do you see the current free thought movement as a modern day Enlightenment?
Well, of course. Yes, we are the legacy and the inheritors of that amazing historical movement.
And what about, you mentioned optimism. Do you ever find that optimism is lacking in our movement? That things seem a bit too doom and gloom at times?
Well, I suppose there certainly are lots of frustrations that we all deal with at times. But the very fact that we've individually taken a stand and on these values and these beliefs, I think, is a statement of optimism in itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important for me to be identified with this movement and to do what I can. I believe that change can happen, and I believe if it's to be, it's up to me, as I think a Christian theologian once said. So, I disagree that we lack optimism. I think the optimism is there all the time, although it can be challenging.
All right. Well, Stuart, thank you for taking the time to talk to us on Radio Free Thinker, and please join us again in the future.
Great. Thank you very much.
Joining us once again on Radio Freethinker is Jen McCrite. Jen, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
So, how is Kamloops treating you?
Oh, good so far. Really enjoying the conference. Pretty dry here.
Excellent. So, I assume you've heard of the big news, the sudden disappearance of the Atheist Bus ads.
Yes.
What's your take on this?
You know, it's not surprising, but it's still unfortunate. We see these sort of vandalisms happening across the country whenever atheists try to put ads up. But in a weird way, it's kind of good for us because it's a lot of free publicity on how people react to atheists just saying they exist. But from what I've heard about how the company is treating it, it's kind of disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, they're not being very cooperative from what I hear.
As I understand it, it's been quite the bureaucratic hurdle to get the ads, and now they're saying they'll replace them, but you have to pay for them again, which is just silly.
Yeah, it seems pretty ludicrous.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of controversies to discuss. The first one that I wanted to talk about was an incident that occurred at the American Atheist Southeast Regional Atheist Meet in Alabama.
Okay.
Don't worry, I'm not gonna cause any trouble. But I'm actually curious, you know, there was the initial blog post that started it. There was a lot of back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
After sort of everything settled down a bit, what can you sort of tell us about looking back on it?
You know, I still stand by the fact that these sort of things need to be pointed out, that when something uncomfortable happens at conferences that reflect on diversity issues, that not only do we need to bring it up to organizers, but we do need to make public statements about them because, you know, there are plenty of people in the audience who, if something happens and they feel offended or they feel not welcome, that if if something behind the scenes happens where people are trying to make things better, they don't know about it. So by just publicly saying, hey, we had a problem with this too, that can be really comforting to a lot of people who also have a problem with it. But yeah, I think overall, there was a lot of back and forth and some of it very angry. But I think it showed the need for this movement to start thinking about diversity issues and being really willing to discuss it.
Were you surprised by the fact people got really angry about it?
To the level that it got, yeah, I was surprised. I mean, I'm used to a lot of my posts that have to do with feminism in some way. I usually get some level of flack, so I'm getting used to it. But yeah, I was surprised just how personally a lot of people took it. People in attendance who they didn't personally see something as being offensive, so they assume everyone should feel the same way as they did. So yeah, I was surprised just how upset a lot of people got about just simply saying some things didn't sit well with them.
Right. Well, another big controversy that's come up, and this is, I think, a intersection of feminism and skepticism crossing paths, is the new bill passed in the U.S., H.R. 3, the No Taxpayer Funding for Abortion Act,
yeah,
which prevents women from seeking abortions, and that it stops insurance companies from paying for it. It also allows hospitals to turn away women who need emergency pregnancy terminations. Yep. So my question is, this is a political issue, and a lot of skeptics and organizations that are skeptical will shy away from political issues. Mm-hmm. So how do we change that? How do we turn that tide around and say, no, this is in fact a skeptical issue that we have to address?
I think we have to look at the reasoning behind these laws, well, the bad reasoning behind these laws, because often it's very religious and unskeptical in nature, and you can make a skeptical argument as to why these laws are wrong, even if they're dealing with a political issue. I mean, oh god, this issue is just so upsetting to me on a personal level. The whole thing behind this law is people are like, oh, well, we shouldn't fund abortion, but this is going to affect the women who need abortions for medical reasons, because the women who are affluent enough to maybe pay for an early abortion, they're not going to probably still have enough money to pay for medical abortions later, because they're thousands and thousands of dollars when it's life of the mother involved. I can't even form concise statements, but we shouldn't shy away from things just because they have some political bent to it, because people are going to be hurt, and some people are even going to die because these unscientific ideas are being put into law. I know back in my home state of Indiana, they just passed a law where you have to say, I forget the number of weeks, but that at a certain number of weeks, a fetus can feel pain, and it's just scientifically untrue that the cutoff they put at. So they're just passing bad ideas into law.
Right.
And that's a perfect example of where we should be able to say, no, why are you forcing doctors to tell this to patients when it's not true? It's not scientific.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there is any sort of logic in trying to keep organized skepticism independent of politics?
I think when it's politics that isn't rooted in science, like maybe economic issues, but when it's science-based medical arguments and they're making laws that are just not based in science, that we should be able to speak up because of it.
Right. So you're not too worried about putting off people who might be on the political right, but who claim, or well, who say they're skeptics? It seems like most of our supporters are already on the
yeah.
political left anyway.
I was gonna say, how many are we putting off? I very, very rarely run into skeptics who are socially conservative. And I think that's because a lot of more liberal social ideas are rooted in skepticism to an extent. I mean, I don't think we should endorse certain politicians or certain political parties, but I think you can definitely touch on different topics that are going on in current events.
Okay. Well, another current event is the recent ban on wearing face veils in France.
Mm-hmm.
And you touched on this in your talk today.
Yep.
On the one hand, most people would agree that it's a religious tool of suppression of women.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it's also a choice to wear it in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this sort of paradoxical idea that we're trying to liberate women by dictating what they can and can't wear.
Yeah.
Also, the notion that they might just stay indoors, and then you're depriving them of a free society that they might change their minds on.
Yeah.
Do you have any way of navigating this tricky minefield?
Yeah, it's one of those things where I definitely personally, it doesn't sit well with me that a lot of these women are being forced to wear this, and it's a sign of oppression. But the big thing for me is when we make these laws, we have to think about, is this actually helping the women? And a lot of these cases, these women aren't going to be able to leave the house anymore or go to university because they can't wear this. So it's really just oppressing women even more to make a straight-out ban on it. Not to mention the whole argument that there are some women who wear it perfectly by choice. Someone's not shoving it on their head. And maybe their reasoning behind it is just what other people have told them, but we can't automatically dictate what's right and wrong for these women. I can understand the reasoning behind it, but I think it sort of misses its goal, and that if we're trying to free women from this oppression, we're accidentally just oppressing them more by forcing them to not wear it.
What's your thoughts on the notion that perhaps there's an undertow of xenophobia mm-hmm. in these kind of laws, that this is actually being racially motivated and not freedom motivated?
Yeah, I think to an extent that's probably true. I mean, we have certain standards of modesty in the U.S. where, you know, women will get harassed for wearing too skimpy of clothing or certain types of clothing, and it's just a totally a cultural difference as to what clothing is considered immodest. So I think part of it is, you know, racially motivated or Islamophobia, but at the same time, you know, I'm still a very strong proponent that we still should be able to criticize things like Islam, even if we have other people who are criticizing it only because, you know, they're right. from the Middle East.
Right. And you also talked about religious oppression of women that's not just Abrahamic religions, mm-hmm. Hinduism, Buddhism. They don't get as much play in our sort of skeptical circle.
Yeah.
Perhaps they should get more. Could you expand on that a bit?
Sure, yeah. Well, I think the reason why they don't get more play is just most skepticism is United States, Canada, UK. It's all very Christian populated countries. But yeah, you know, when you start delving into other religions, they have just as bad things going on. You know, Hinduism, it says right in the Vedas that a woman is always subject to her children, her husband, her father. And that's where a lot of the whole idea of women being below men in the caste system comes from, or dowry deaths and sex selective abortion. And in Buddhism, women, you know, where they're seen as, that's what you get reincarnated as if you did something bad, that we can't become Buddha, we're a step below man. And I say even Jainism, which Sam Harris is always like, oh, well, if everyone's Jain, the world would be lovely because they're so nonviolent. But they see women as being inherently violent because of menstruation. So they're still seen as below men in that sense. And I think a lot of Westerners, for whatever reason, maybe they reject organized religion in the Abrahamic sense, and a lot of them turn to Buddhism or Jainism and sort of see it as the kinder religion. But they tend to do very Americanized versions of Buddhism. If you actually look at what's being practiced on the other side of the world, it's not all roses.
Right. Do you think that there's something just inherent in religion that causes or encourages suppression of women, or is the religion just sort of reflecting a sexist society?
I think it's mostly a reflection, but it's not just societal. It's the fact that religion makes it untouchable, and that it might be reflecting whatever society thought at the time, but now it's unchanging for the last 2,000 years because you can't question it or change it because that's God's word. So I think it's a way that sexist beliefs sort of get ingrained in our society instead of being kicked out when we realize how stupid they are.
Would you agree maybe with the notion that sexism is sort of a meme that kind of keeps coming up for a reason, and that religion is just a convenient vessel to pass it along?
I think to an extent, yeah. You know, humans like to categorize and label, and I think superficially it's easy to be like, oh, men do this, women do that, and it's very pleasing to our brains to just think that way until you actually start investigating. You're like, oh, they aren't really that different. So I think, yeah, religion just helps to perpetuate those sort of memes, makes it harder to get rid of them.
Excellent. And I understand that you're working hard on your blog, trying to solve these issues. When do you think you'll have this cleared up?
Next month, maybe.
No. Okay, sounds good. Excellent. Well, Jen, thanks for joining us on Radio Free Thinker, and please join us again in the future.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks.
And we're back here on Radio Free Thinker. So our thanks to Stuart and Jen for talking with us while they were in Kamloops. You know, it occurs to me that we didn't go into too much detail about the controversy at the American Atheist Southeast Regional Atheist Meeting in Alabama. That is a long title for an event. So just for people who don't know what happened, there was this forum on diversity, and they were talking about typical things about how to increase membership of women and people of minorities in the skeptical movement. And one of the things they were talking about was, are men flirting with women at these events, and was that, putting women off and driving them away? And that sort of, hit a nerve with some people. And the tone of the discussion kind of got a bit exclusive. And then a few women in the audience tried to express their opinion on this. And unfortunately, there was what has been described as a communication breakdown, and things got a bit, heated and arrogant, in my opinion.
So Ethan, when you say flirting,
yeah,
what do you mean by flirting? And when you also say exclusive, what do you mean?
Well, so I think what they were talking about when they were talking about flirting is women feeling like they're coming to this event to see, say, a lecture. They don't want to be, hit on by a bunch of men who are their father's age, kind of leering at them or something. And now I think for Vancouver listeners, this is a bit different because our skeptical movement is actually quite young. But I think in a lot of other cities, and from my experience as well, the skeptical free thought movement is quite a bit older than the Vancouver sort of average age. So you tend to get this sort of discrepancy where you get a lot of older, typically white men, and sometimes you get younger folks as well. But I think the notion was, are men inappropriately choosing the wrong moments to flirt with these young women?
So was this a situation of a cultural norm that happens to be being exhibited in a skeptic setting? It could have been a convention of shoe salespeople or whatever, and the same sort of thing could have occurred, or is this something that's specific to the skeptic community?
That's a good question. I don't really have a great answer for that one. I'm leaning towards you could see this at any kind of convention, but I think it's especially pronounced at like a skeptical conference, because there usually is a fairly big discrepancy between women attending and men attending. So I think it's a bit more visible for the women who experience it a lot more. Whereas if you're at a convention on something mundane where you might have a more 50-50 split, you're not going to notice it perhaps as much. But what really sort of brought the conversation to a heated point was that I think a woman was trying to make a point and she was sort of being ignored, so she just stood up and started yelling, and the forum speakers, from what I understand, didn't handle that very well, got a bit snipey, and a few people kind of walked out in frustration. The problem got worse, I think, when people read a blog post by Liz Linden and Sharon Moss, who were two freethought activists, and Jen let them blog it on her blog. And people, I think, really took it as an attack, when it wasn't really an attack. It was just saying, hey, people were really upset about by this. People thought they were saying, oh, the atheist group in Alabama was a sexist group. And communication breakdown again, and more sniping. And, ultimately, I think what it just demonstrated was that people were getting really defensive when someone was trying to say, listen, I'm not saying that you did something wrong, but I'm saying that these people felt offended. And there has to be some way to discuss it without you guys getting offended and us feeling excluded.
And I think, this is going to tie back to the course on secularism, is one thing skeptics have to come to mind is that we are embedded within a culture and a society, and that does come with baggage that's going to come out. And that if you go to an event and again, this cultural baggage comes out. You can't avoid the cultural baggage. We are embedded in a society that is a sexist society that has all this other stuff coming with it. But it also gives us a unique opportunity because we profess to have all these skeptical skills about being able to take reason and logic and apply them to particular issues. We should be able to take that same sort of mindset, that same sort of tool chest, and say, okay, we can't change society, but maybe we can change the secular community that's embedded in society and approach this in a skeptic sort of rationalist sort of way.
Absolutely. And I think that's what that blog post was trying to do. Again, I think it was just sort of misinterpreted, but that's why it was a controversy and that's why I asked Jen about it.
You know, and we're running out of time, Ethan. Do you have any skeptic highlights?
You know what I do? I actually do. Speaking of Jen, I found out that she's going to be a guest on Dan Savage's podcast, Savage Love. So check that out if you like that podcast. My main skeptical highlight this week is I want to direct people to CFI Canada's YouTube channel, Think Again. They have a new video up where Justin Trottier tries to investigate the missing atheist bus ads in Kelowna. And I think people would like seeing this. It's quite interesting, and it's actually a little shocking to see the treatment he gets from transit authorities there in Kelowna. And we'll have a link to that in our show notes as well.
And I have a skeptic low light. Oh. There's something, perhaps an opportunity for some skepticism. There is a discussion, quote unquote, going on called Vaccination Science and Politics. What Should We Believe? By biochemist Lucija Tomjanovic, who discusses, quote unquote, evidence-based medicine and whether it supports the contention that vaccination saves lives with negative adverse effects. This is being held at the Unitarian Church of Vancouver, 949 49th Street West, on May 19th, 7:30. Now, for those who are wondering, they use one of our catchphrases, evidence-based medicine. We like that phrase. Sadly, she is a researcher with Chris Shaw's outfit who sits there and professes that are doing research into the neurotoxic effects of aluminum vaccine adjuvants. If I pronounce that right, essentially that vaccines kill nerve cells, or so that's sort of the premise.
And I would say that the term evidence-based medicine actually isn't that preferred by a lot of our skeptics. They prefer the term science-based medicine because even pseudoscience can be evidentiary-based if it's anecdotal evidence.
I accept your smackdown, Ethan, and will correct myself in future. Looking at some of the research that she's done, and we've had Chris Shaw on our show before, these are people who, in their own way, I mean, they're doing research into the effects of aluminum on neurocells, which is not actually a very good model for the effects of vaccines on the neurosystem. So in the one sense, I mean, they're doing some science that's valid, but they're misapplying it in regions that maybe it doesn't quite suit. And we were talking in the break about, you know, I'm really kind of curious to know who's funding this kind of research, because it's being done here at UBC, and it seems to be really, really kind of tainted in one direction or another. It's under the premise, I believe, of Alzheimer's, which is a totally different thing, again, from vaccination, and it just seems like a great opportunity for some of the skeptic community to show up to this and offer a little pushback against the misapplication of science at this particular event.
And it's free, so why not show up?
Woo-hoo.
Well, we're out of time here on Radio Freethinkers, so this is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
You really want to know what love is?
Yeah. Yes.